Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
Dr. Jennifer Daniel, and you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniel on the Blake Radio Network at Rainbow Soul. Okay, today's topic is poverty and health and wealth, of course. Well, this is a question that's just really plagued me since the beginning, since I was first even interested in health, healing, and healthcare. It never occurred to me that there was any relationship between poverty and health. Why? I grew up in a ghetto, and everybody was pretty healthy, especially all the kids. Everybody was healthy. There was no childhood sickness, and nobody wanted to see a doctor for anything. That was just considered why foolishness or malingering. But actually, our parents told us we weren't welcome there anyway. The doctor's office, there's no point in going, because it just wasn't going to be pleasant anyway. You sliced it. But we really just didn't have any understanding or awareness of the concept of going to the doctor or being sick. And then I went to college, and I think I went to the doctor once because I had vomiting and diarrhea from some bad stuff I ate at a party. But really, I didn't see a doctor again. But I was curious at that point. I knew I lived in the ghetto and everybody there was poor, and I wanted to be a doctor so I could help people get healthier. I went to the library. I said, what's the difference, what's the relationship between poverty and health? In other words, is it possible for poor people to be healthy? So I got a few books and started reading. I was absolutely shocked to find that once you had a roof over your head, pretty much, clean water to drink, and food to eat, there really wasn't much else that medicine or more money could do for your health. I thought, that's interesting. And of course, I went to medical school. The medical school, they explained to us that if you were poor, man, you were sick. I mean, a big, kind of whole lot of sick. And of course, if you're wealthy, why, you just needed the confidence of the doctor to maintain your status, so to speak. So I was still very confused. And they also told me in medical school that people were poor and could not afford to afford health care, and of course, needed the government to pay for it. I scratched my head on that one, too. I thought I just didn't understand it. So tonight, what I'm going to talk about is the relationship between health and your financial state. So let's say you happen to be poor. Does it mean because you're poor that you have to be unhealthy? And what if you're wealthy? Does it mean because you're wealthy you're going to be healthy? Well, you know, something wrong, it's a very obvious example. You know, we have president. So we have President Clinton, who developed chest pain, heart attack, had one botched surgery, had a second surgery, they thought they got it right. Then got more chest pain, had a third surgery, and finally turned to natural healing. And by all reports, he's had no further episodes in the past couple of years since he's accessed natural healing as his new method of healing. And so that's an example of a wealthy person. Another example of a wealthy person. When I say wealthy, we'll just say someone who has enough money to, where money is not a limiting factor in how they manage their affairs. Let's say Vice President Cheney, for all of his wealth, which is usually his wealth there, he somehow needed a pacemaker, an implantable defibrillator, and a few other new fan things, and I hear tell he recently had a transplant. So, we can see then that wealth definitely does not confer health. That's pretty straightforward. We take a look at what's right before our nose. Well, what about poverty? I know all these stories about poor people. And poor people not being able to afford housing. The question is, does the inability to afford doctor visits create sickness? And I think it's a difficult argument to make. It's a difficult association to draw. Well, my conclusion, after looking at all of this stuff and practicing medicine for 10 years and now no longer practicing medicine, and observing people and how they manage their affairs, it seems to me the relationship between poverty, health, and wealth is how a person chooses to handle their health. This is very important. So, in other words, a person can be healthy regardless of their economic status, whether they're extremely wealthy or whether they're extremely poor. The difference between being healthy, living a healthy life until your final years, until like 80 or 90, is how you manage your health or your illness, however you want to look at it. And this really struck me the other night. My husband watches these videos on YouTube. So I happened upon this YouTube video put out by this organization that's working very hard to stamp out poverty in America and at the same time improve people's health. So the first video was a couple that was in the suburbs and had three children, and things went pretty well until finally the wife had, of course, an autistic child. And still things, you know, chugged along. Both parents are working, things are going very well. The husband was a creative type, a musician who did creative work for various large industrial giants. And unfortunately, he developed multiple sclerosis. And as a result of that, could not work. I mean, his income was lost, leaving only her working. Of course, that was not enough to handle family affairs, and they plunged sponsor into poverty. Now, of course, he's been going to his doctor. He's been getting many tests and medications, of course. And I'm sure he's been taking his medications, which so they suggested. And what, as the show went on, he continued to use his cane, and they talked about how they were unable to manage because of this loss of income. And of course, now she has an autistic child and a husband with multiple sclerosis, and the whole thing was just overwhelming. Now, multiple sclerosis, even the regular doctors are finally confessing. In undertones, they're not talking too loud about it, but they're confessing. Respond incredibly to diet. But of course, this family had numerous meals of macaroni and cheese. Now, those of you who are listening, if you've ever made macaroni and cheese from scratch, you know it is not an inexpensive meal. By the time you get through paying for cheese and milk, it's a pretty pricey dish. You might as well have bought fresh organic ones in fact. So, just looking at the video, looking at the way that they were eating, the processed foods that they were eating, it was clear where his multiple sclerosis came from and where the cure lies. However, instead, this unfortunate family was swaddling around with therapies that were not particularly effective. In fact, we'll talk later about those, proven to be, you might say, ineffective. So, this in the kernel is the cause of particularly family poverty. Even if you are well-to-do, which they were, and you're spending a tremendous amount of money, creative type, he's good at what he did, life work as well, even if you're earning a sizable sum of money, if you rely on the standard of care from a licensed, accredited, trained, credentialed medical team, you will eventually become not only poor, but quite ill. My second example is a little more subtle, actually. In this case, what happened was a single mother had a job as a nurse, and if you're in the United States, you know nurses in the United States earn a fair amount of money between $40,000 and $100,000, depending on the size of the nursing you do. She had a daughter who was in private school because she felt education was very important. She wanted her daughter to have an education. And things were actually going very well. She was putting aside for a 401k for her retirement. And then her mother became ill, and she made the decision, a very devoted daughter, Mike, to move her mother into her house and take care of her mother. And she took care of her mother for about 2 years. And she lived off of her savings for those 2 years. And at the end of the 2 years, she decided, okay, great, it's time to go back to work. Unfortunately, there were no nursing jobs in her area to be had at that time. And so this lack of employment hung on for a very long time. I might add that her daughter was at least 10 years old, just from the looks of the picture. And so this person's decision, now she was a nurse, but no, just piece of information. Her decision concerning her mother's care was to move her mother in with her, quit her job, and take care of her mother. Now, I would like to suggest another choice, which, by the way, many other cultures around the world use, which is, you have here a 10-year-old, and you can say to the 10-year-old, look, you need to stay home. We're going to homeschool you for a couple of years here, and you're going to take care of grandma. And at the end of the day, when I get home, you and grandma are both going to tell me all the great adventures you had while I was at work. That's it. If you don't really trust the situation, you can just take your 15-minute break. It's a long United States, you know, every 2 hours, you get a 15-minute break. And then, of course, at lunchtime, you get a good half an hour. Make a phone call home. If nobody answers, send out the truth, so to speak. But the decision of how this person chose to handle a health care crisis, that was the determining factor in her decline into poverty. Now, you say, well, she didn't have a daughter. Again, you're looking at, a lot of times, a decision to rely either on agency or whatever, but the decision of how you handle healthcare crises in your life is the determinant in terms of how of your wealth. So if you rely on yourself, if you rely on natural healing methods, first of all, your outcome is going to be better. Not because natural healing is so effective. Let's just say for a moment, concede the naysayers, natural healing, no benefit at all. Just throw it out there. Even with no benefit at all, placebo has a 33% cure rate. A 33% cure rate. Compare that to medical intervention, which has a cure rate hovering, what is the cure rate, effectiveness rate, hovering around 1%. In other words, if you do nothing, and by the way, we doctors have been trained that if someone is doing natural healing, which is changing their diet, taking free supplements, cleansing, that's classified as doing nothing. We know that that has a 33% cure rate of placebo. And we know that doctors' methods, again, research, doctors' own research, all these research studies we're going to go over here today, indicate the effectiveness of care received from a trained, certified, credentialed physician following the standard of care. It's approximately more or less 1%, on average, 1% effective. In some cases, it rises as high as 10%. So this is the premise. The premise is that if you rely on the present healthcare system in the United States as it's presently organized, then you will soon lose certainly your wealth and soon to follow your health. Now, let's just reemphasize the plight of the poor, because this is really a difficult situation the poor find themselves in. The real issue with the poor is that they have something called a Medicaid card, which means that they have compulsory immunizations, which we know to be harmful, and compulsory compliance with the standard of care. If they don't comply with the standard of care, there's child protective, there's the elderly abuse people, there's a whole cadre of bureaucrats to compel them to fit the standard of care. And that's quite the dismal thing, which you'll see in a moment. Then they have something called food stamps. Food stamps basically is a blank check which entitles the bearer to receive a supply of poison-laced food. And then, of course, they receive subsidized, maybe housing, daycare, and a few other things. The determining factor, I think, in the health would be the compulsory compliance with the standard of care and the unlimited access to illness-creating foods. These two things conspire to make sure that the poor are sick. Back in the 60s, before the poverty movement or anti-poverty movement got going real good, poor people were growing their own crops in the backyard. Yeah, they felt really humiliated. But they were growing their own crops. They were bartering with other people, all kinds of ways to try and get by. And as a result, you know, the children of the poor often were pretty sturdy and had pretty good health. We don't see that in modern times. In fact, a lot of kids these days are pretty sickly. We don't see this extremely strong group of underclass children who would grow up to be professional sports stars. I think we're going to see an end to that pretty quickly here. And then the issue with the wealthy, of course, is they are spending money on care that's very expensive, not effective, and even harmful. So spending $1 with less than 1% chance of benefit, as in any kind of prostate-related intervention, and 25% chance of harm, the overall chance of side effects if you accept any medication, will quickly create sickness in any wealthy person. Simply this practice of accessing the present healthcare system for their health. So the choice or decision to engage in modern healthcare with a qualified medical professional who sticks to the standard of care creates sickness and poverty as a result of its use. So this is a strategy that fails on both levels. Now, let's take a look at how someone might live to the age of 95 and not be impoverished and not be sick. All right. This is a headline. That's not the headline. The headline reads, lawsuit, police shot 95-year-old World War II veteran to death with beanbag round. Yeah, from year 95, a beanbag shotgun to the belly would probably do you in too. But this guy is 95 years old. He was living in an assisted living facility. What does that mean? An assisted living facility is not quite a nursing home. And to live in an assisted living facility, it takes some change. You can't live there and be penniless. So this guy, maybe he wasn't rich, but he had a few pennies left at the age of 95, which in the United States is definitely an accomplishment. I'm here in Panama with many Americans here. Here's a debt they might outlive their money. So what happened? So police shot this veteran to death with beanbag rounds at close range because he refused to go to the hospital. Now, this is probably not the first time he refused to go to the hospital. It's probably how he got to be 95. But this time when he refused, he got shot with beanbags by the police, and he died. He succumbed. And so the incident occurred July 26, 2013, in a center in Park Forest, Illinois. And this young man, who was just 12 days shy of his 96th birthday, was suffering from a sus- suspected, not confirmed, suspected urinary tract infection. Just for your information, if it really was a urinary tract infection, left untreated in a 96-year-old, if he was going to die, it would probably take at least two weeks untreated for him to die. And the way he would die would be that the infection would spread outside his bladder and cause sepsis. However, when Victory Center employees attempted to persuade him to get into an ambulance and go to the hospital, he refused to leave his room. Now, there is a sign of hell. If a person can offer physical resistance, then they don't need to go to the hospital, certainly not in an ambulance. He subsequently brandished a knife and a long shoehorn in an attempt to resist paramedics. Now, we have to examine this thing for a long shoehorn, yes. You would expect a 96-year-old man might not be able to bend over to get his shoes on, and he might certainly possess a long shoehorn. A knife. Don't you think they would have frisked the guy before he moved into this facility and taken away a knife? Maybe it was a butter knife, or was it really a fork? We don't know. I guess we'll have to investigate that. So five police officers, we don't need to name names, were called to the scene before Commander ordered force to be used against this unfortunate 95-year-old individual. Now, on entering the room and missing with a taser dart, how can you miss a taser dart? You've got a 96-year-old man. He is not moving that fast. How can you miss him with a taser? But they did. They even think the taser is unconscionable, but that they missed I'm speechless, but they missed. Then he fired five rounds of beanbag cartridges from a 12-gauge shotgun within a distance of approximately 6 to 8 feet. Those assisted living rooms are not very big. Once you're at the door, you're pretty much 6 feet away from whoever's in the room. And this poor man fell. This is far less than the distance allowed for discharging that shotgun and consequently savagely wounding and killing this individual. Now, I've taken shotgun practice, and I can tell you just the kickback from a shotgun could kill a 96-year-old person, let alone shooting them at close range, which is 8 feet away. All right, so he bled to death, predictable, internal bleeding, as a result of the shotgun wound inflicted upon him by the police. And the county medical examiner ruled that his death was a homicide. I find this shocking. You would think they would stick together, but what the heck. Caused by blunt force trauma to his abdomen as a result of shots fired from beanbag shotgun. Now, the lawsuit alleges police should have known that the 190-mile-per-hour beanbag rounds would have caused injury or death to this individual, and family members are insisting this 95-year-old was not a threat to anyone. I would have to agree with the family. They could have just shut the door and let the guy cool down, but they didn't. I mean, it doesn't take a 96-year-old mom to get winded, you know what I mean, just wear himself out like a kid. A 3-year-old throwing a tantrum, you just close the door, let him wear himself out. Anyway, so the attorney who's representing the six police officers claimed that lethal force was justified because Rona threatened to throw a knife at them. Now, the suit alleges that cops acted willfully, wantonly, intentionally, knowingly, maliciously, in bad faith, and with deliberate disregard. Okay. Now, you're probably wondering, geez, are the police right or are the police wrong? I think if that's what you're thinking, you're really missing the point of this piece. This piece is an excellent example of how you live to be 95 years old and still have two pennies to rub together. You resist medical care. This is not the first time this guy resisted medical care. Probably he's been resisting it for some time, but that is how I got to be 96, by resisting medical care. That's number one. Number two. We have talked on our episodes about the government's policies. When I say policies, I mean, for example, the Inspector General of the Medicare system issued a report saying he's well aware that 180,000 Medicare recipients die every year as a result of receiving medical care. This is an astronomical death rate. And this death rate is not from their primary illness. This is from their receipt of health care paid for by the United States government. So we have a government engaged in funding a program whose murder rate is reprehensibly high. I mean, 180,000 murders a year, that's pretty impressive. I'm not counting the Medicare people who die of natural causes. I will concede those. I'm only addressing the ones the Medicare program itself has confessed to. Again, I only use medical figures for the medical industry themselves. I don't want to have any kind of negative bias to these figures. So, the point is this. Had they got Mr. Rona, his name, to agree to get into the ambulance and go to the hospital for his suspected urinary tract infection, it is very likely he would have been murdered at the hospital. We have a chain of events here. And the whole sequence of events here is designed to lead to the death of this 96-year-old guy. The first chain of events is he pays into Medicare all of his life as a young working buck. Next chain of events. Actually, Medicare, let's see, like six, yeah, he paid in a couple years. So, pays into Medicare, he retires, he's now on Medicare. So, first event is he paid into the Medicare system. That was the first mistake. Second, once he retired, he was now covered by Medicare. By the way, you don't get to refuse Medicare coverage. Part of it just happens, the hospital part. And then, as time went on, I'm sure along the line he refused medical care, but he was able to do that because he's living in his own home. Now he moves to an assisted living facility, which means he's able to do a lot of things for himself. He needs a little assistance or supervision because he can't do everything. Assisted living facilities are certified. What does that mean, is certified? That means that they are obligated to adhere to standards and to make sure that the people who live there get medical attention, or it's elder abuse if that medical attention is not received. So because the facility is certified, there's this obligation. No. Because he's in an assisted living facility, we can guess that he's middle class, somewhere in there. He's maybe making some partial payments, and Medicare is paying the rest, or there's some kind of, you know, this personal investment involved there. You can see his family cared about him. They were very careful to get him in just the right place where he would not be abused. And so here he is in his room with his shoehorn and I'm sure, a butter knife or spork, but the investigation will reveal what it really was he had in his hand. Resisting medical care. All he's doing, resisting medical care, saying, no, thank you. This is not what I want to do. I'm going to stay in my room, thank you. And at 96 years old, he's already beat the average lifespan of a compliant American male of 76 years old. So he's outlived by 20 years. The average American male who gets medical care and does what he's directed to do is 76 years old. He's like the doctor at 76 years old if you get the standard of care. Well, this guy, 96 years old, steadfastly refusing the standard of care. So standard of care would have killed him sooner, but he refused it. So here he is at 96, continuing to refuse, and the police say, no, you must go. This is your time. And that is their job. These policemen are doing their job. Absolutely. Now, this individual is not cooperating. So the question is, who killed him? Is it reasonable to hold the policeman responsible when all they were doing was delivering him to almost certain death? So you have to take a look at that. What do you do with someone 96 who has a suspected urinary tract infection? Well, by golly, you give him antibiotics. At 96, what does that do? It gives him a hospital antibiotic-resistant hospital-acquired infection, of course. And what does that do at 96? Check out. So you have a system here, the assisted living facility, had they picked this annual facility, that would have done it. But no, we have a caring family and an astute young man here, and between him and his family, they picked an assisted living facility that was not going to kill him. Okay, good. But the facility is certified. What does that mean? That means that it's their job, when they suspect he's ill, to make sure he receives the standard of care, or they lose their certification. In other words, they're not allowed to respect his wishes. Not allowed to respect his wishes. They are obligated, because they're certified, to make sure that their client, their residents, get the standard of care. And so then, when he said, no, I won't go, they're like, oh boy, if he doesn't go, and all that can get audited. we're going to be in big trouble. And so what did they do? They had to call the paramedics. Okay, you know what? We got to make the phone call. Got to make the phone call out of our hands. Now I'll tell you, as a doctor, there are situations where they came up in the office where I was supposed to make the phone call. And I would say to the patient, look, I'm going to forget I even heard that. I'm not going to make the phone call. So, you're going to pretend I didn't hear that. You didn't say that. And I won't see you back in 2 or 3 days. I think you're going. Because I just don't really see any reason to send you to jail or lock you up or whatever. And so it's a tough call. But when you're in an assisted living facility, you have these employees, there's all this documenting going on, you really can't make that kind of agreement with the resident on the spot. Can't really do that. But what my husband and I disagree with this. He's a retired policeman as well. And he was incensed. He was so angry about what these policemen said. He got so worked up. I said, honey, they're just doing their job. They're just doing their job. I mean, today, it's under the guise of getting this guy needed care, but it's not needed care. There's no such thing as needed care when the effectiveness of the care is, you know, less than 1%, and the harm rate is 25%, and the Medicare patients, 180,000 are being murdered every year. That's huge. That is huge. If the standard of care applied to Medicare patients and accessibility to it, Medicare patients have, would be extended to the whole population, the number of dead people in America would increase by over 1 million people a year. That's the true horror of Obamacare, if indeed it does create free access that it has promised. So we're hoping that, I'm hoping, that the access promised by Obamacare doesn't materialize, because it would be a lot of deaths. All right, so that's what this story really reveals. Of course, the family is suing and all of this stuff. But the point of the real point of the case here is that the police were actually doing their job. It is their job to deliver the city's citizens to their demise, and it is. And it's just that now it's under the guise of helping them. But I think if this is not stopped, then pretty soon this will be compulsory. You'll just get a little letter telling you your numbers come up and you need to report for neutralization or some such euphemism. So let's take a look at other things that will give some insight into the relationship between sickness and poverty. I mean, we only look so far as the FDA drug approvals and changes. This is very revealing, so I'm going to talk about this. There's a drug called Bavlin, so it's 17 drugs. And this one is supposed to help acute bacterial skin and skin structure infections, especially MRSA. These are the infections you get in the hospital because the hospital gave you the standard of care, because the hospital gave you antibiotics. This is the infection that you get. And so now they have another drug for these infections they think is going to be helpful. And it's a lipoglycopeptide antibiotic. Interferes with cell wall system. Now, I was told in medical school that humans don't have cell walls. They don't have to worry. But wait a minute. We have cell membranes made up of what? Lipo, fat, glyco, sugars, peptides, protein. Ha-ha. So if this interferes with fats, sugars, and proteins, it's also going to interfere with the cell wall of your cell, you being a human being. And so the dose is 1,000 milligrams, which is 1 gram, and then half a gram a week later. All right. So stay tuned for Delvance, and we expect great things from Delvance. Next, now this is shocking. This is NTVO. New drug for Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, as indicated for moderate and severe Crohn's disease. And so what they're saying is 39% of those assigned to the drug group were in clinical remission at 52 weeks, compared to 21.6% assigned to placebo. And so we subtract 39% from 21%, and we find that 18% of people who took this actually benefited. 18% benefited. What does that mean? 21% were going to get better just because they would have got better with nothing. And 60% didn't get better because they didn't get better with or without the drug. And so it only made a difference in the life of about 18% of those who took it. And so this is a recombinant humanized monoclonal antibody. Let me put that in English. It's a genetically modified organism. So this is a genetically modified substance that's being used to treat Crohn's disease, which we know to be aggravated by eating genetically modified foods. And so, again, we can expect great things from Entyvio, and we'll be hearing about that in the near future, I'm sure. Now, again, so these are drugs. So we know, because it's genetically modified, we're looking forward to seeing, and we will certainly see, a fair amount of harm. So if you would not eat genetically modified food, why would you allow genetically modified drugs to enter your body day after day for years on end? I don't know. Speak to me. Now, here's a good one. Zontivity. It's a new drug for thromboembolic prophylaxis. What does that mean? That means it prevents blood clots. And it's used to reduce blood clots and heart attacks in patients with a history of heart attack or with peripheral arterial disease. I mean, smokers who have blocked arteries in their feet. Just trying to put this in simple language here. Approval was based on the thrombin receptor antagonist in secondary prevention of atherothrombotic ischemic events study. Okay. The fact that the approval was based on a study is already a little troublesome. And it shows that coronary revascularization was decreased by 13% in patients taking this. Coronary revascularization, that's something we should want to have. We should want to have blood vessels growing. We should want to have coronary artery collaterals growing to get blood to the heart. But anyway, it stops us at 13% of patients taking it. And we showed that time to cardiovascular death or stroke was decreased. Okay. So 13% decrease in time to cardiovascular death, heart attack, stroke, or need for surgery. So at least 13%, we don't know how many lives were saved because it's thrown in with a lot of other things that don't involve saving anybody's life. So as a dose, so you have to take it with aspirin or clopidogrel. Now, what's the significance of that? Well, aspirin and its other substance are also blood thinners. So we take it with another blood thinner. And then we don't know if it saves any lives or how many lives it saves, but we do know that it takes longer to have a second heart attack, a stroke, or an urgent need for cardiovascular surgery. This is pretty vague benefit here. Now you're getting the drift. So this is just approved by the FDA. It's on patent. It's not cheap. It's going to cost a fortune. Even if you are pretty wealthy, we're talking big bucks here. This could make you poor, and there's really not particular evidence here that's going to make you healthy. Again, it's this kind of spending on this kind of healthcare expense that can make the rich poor and make them very sick. This is my favorite. Atenova. This is omega-3 carboxylic acid. A new drug for people who have elevated fat. I'm putting this in English for you. It's indicated to be used in addition to diet in patients with severe elevated fat triglycerides. The approval is based on a study which showed a decrease in a certain type of fat over a 12-week period. Did not show any clinical endpoint or benefit, just a decrease in fat. The mechanism is, they believe, omega-3 polyunsaturated fats, or PUFAs, are helpful, and they decrease mitochondrial and periosmal beta oxidation in the liver, and they decrease hepatic lipogenesis. In other words, they may keep your liver from making fat. And you take about 4 grams a day. Wait a minute, time out. Whatever happened to chia seeds and flax seeds, which are ultra high in omega-3, and if you eat a quarter cup of flax seed, you can get 15 grams of omega-3. That's six times the dose in this, and the dose, the price for your flax seed is going to run you, I got to say, $10 a month, I don't think Epanova, just approved by the FDA, is going to be that cheap. It might not even be that effective. So there you have it. What about your flax seeds and your chia seeds? Ophthalmology. This one's a little bit difficult to say if it's going to help anybody. Just a special eye wash to use during surgery, so we'll skip that. Oh, I like this one. Natesto. This is testosterone you guys can spray up your nose. And it's a new drug dosage for this particular drug. And use it if your balls are too small. Hypogonadism. If your balls are too small, you can take this spray up your nose. And indicated for replacement therapy in males for conditions associated with a deficiency or absence of testosterone. So primary small balls, that means you're born with small balls, absent testicles, bilateral twisted testicles, vanishing testicle syndrome. This is almost too much to go into. But the point is, this has been approved in new dosage, and recent information has just come out linking testosterone to increased frequency of blood clots. I don't want to use the word heart attack, but increased blood clots. All right, what else has the FDA got up its sleeve? This is Aloxi. It's a new indication for chemotherapy-induced nausea. It's indicated for prevention in children as young as 1 month old who are receiving chemotherapy. And the dosage, of course, is intravenous, and give it 30 minutes before chemotherapy. Interesting. Now, I had a niece who had vomiting in pregnancy. And they gave her this, not this one, but another drug, had been approved for chemotherapy, nausea, and vomiting. And it didn't work. So I gave her a tea of fennel seeds, and it gave her more relief from her nausea and vomiting than the $250 dose intravenous chemotherapy drug. We can only hope that Aloxi is better. But in any case, try fennel seed first. It's harmless. Okay, we have Vectibix. It's now the FDA has approved it. First line treatment for cancer of the colon that has spread to the rest of your body, and use it in combination with another drug for first line therapy in patients with a certain type of cancer, and it's a human monoclonal antibody to human EGCF receptor. What does that mean? It means it too is genetically modified. Yes. So here you are, person has cancer, and we're going to give them a genetically modified drug when we suspect genetically modified foods are a big part of the cause of cancer. Anyway, I'm sure all of you have seen these pictures of the mice on the internet with their tumors growing out all over them because they ate genetically modified food. All right. A new reason for routine prophylaxis of hemophilia A, indicated for routine prophylaxis to prevent or reduce the frequency of bleeding episodes in adults with hemophilia. I mean, who wouldn't want to do that? And so the ratio of the bleeding frequency was 15.2, 27.2 for on-demand versus prophylaxis, previously approved for prophylaxis in children, and they have a little dose for you there. And the nice thing about this is that hopefully you won't get contamination and other problems. So this is a good time. Lunesta. Lunesta, if you'll remember, is a feel-good drug, antidepressant. The dosage regimen has been revised. The starting dose has been reduced by 50%. So higher doses are known to cause next morning drowsiness / impairment. How many car accidents and crashes had to happen for them to reduce this? You just have to wonder. And they've reduced the dosage to half. Interesting. Drug interactions. NTVO, which is a gastroenterology drug, and this is one that they decided has potential for increased risk of progressive multifocal glucoencephalopathy, that's not good. It means white cells in the brain, and then the brain doesn't work so well. And this is used as a blocker. And so what you're saying then is also vaccines. People who take this can receive non-live vaccines. In other words, live vaccines present a problem. So this is a subtle concession that vaccines are dangerous and can cause infections and problems, so don't take them with a particular drug. Okay. Now, this is another cardiology drug, Zontivity, which we mentioned before. They're saying, the FDA is saying, oops. We can't mix this drug with other drugs that are metabolized by the liver because it slows the liver metabolism. So if you're taking anticoagulants or antiplatelet drugs, which most cardiac people are taking, then these drugs should be monitored periodically due to potential for increased risk of bleeding. That means bleeding to death. Very serious problem. And you can't take it with carbamazepine, St. John's wort, and seizure medicine. Okay, so you guys are getting the drift. So if you invest your dollars in healing with these synthetic methods that are fraught with complications, that are based on genetically modified technology, then all you're going to spend is a lot of money, because genetically modifying substances to make a drug is a shortcut to a sure patent, and the complications are a shortcut for you to your poor health. And then empanoma, we just talked about, the omega-3s, they're like, oops, you'll get prolonged bleeding time. And caution, if you take with anticoagulants or platelet agents, you might just bleed to death. And don't worry, take it anyway, and the doctor will monitor you periodically. So this is what they're telling your doctor. And so it's no wonder then that the strategy of relying on credentialed doctors using the standard of care will not only make you poor, but make you sick as well. Well, we have about 10 minutes left. Let me see if we have any questions. Okay, we have... All right, we've got quite a little conversation going on in the chat room. So one person asked, is it that people are simply willfully ignorant? I would have to say no, because I'm actually on a special email list, and I get this stuff every day. I mean, tons of it. I could do a show like this every single day of the week. Let me tell you guys where this website is. I think you guys should check it out. Medscape.com. Check it out. Go there. Get yourself a password. Get an account. And start reading this stuff. Like, holy cow. Now, you would be reading it from the standpoint of, oh, my God. I'm docking my... You can't read this stuff. The doctor's reading it from the standpoint of, okay. What am I going to do? Keep my license. Can I go? Okay. All right. What do I do? So there's two different perspectives here, but I think the perspective of... people who are looking at it as if they might actually be prescribed this drug, and that's an important perspective that really needs to be, needs to be heard. Okay, so someone said, nature is nothing but a toy to the extremely powerful. Yes, it is. It is a toy. Consider that. When I went to higher education, we were taught that nature was the enemy. Nature was something to be manipulated. And if you were in the possession of anything natural or unmodified by man, then it really lowered your personal status. The name of the game was to earn enough money to buy as many synthetic things as possible, because everyone knew that synthetic meant that man had improved on nature. And that's the business school angle. Medical school angle is that doctors correct the mistakes that nature makes. So, this is, so yes, nature is definitely a tool, even a toy. Okay. There's limits of conflict protection. Thank you, Steve. Alright, so plants are tremendously powerful protections in place in humans to keep genes from being altered. Possibly, but what's going on here is not so much the genes being altered, but the expression of those genes are being altered by the genetically modified substances. So it's not necessary to alter the human genome itself, although that may be going on. But what actually is happening is the expression of those genes are modified. And that in and of itself is kind of de facto the same as altering the genes, except often when the artificial GMO substance is removed, in this case the drug, the altered expression is removed as well, and the gene starts acting normally. So, yes, you know, the human body does have protections against alterations of genetic expression, but in this case, that's being bypassed by doctors prescribing substances, genetically modified substances that actually alter the body's gene expression. And so we have a situation where the body's defenses are overcome. The monsoon rains are coming in, so you're going to hear kind of a louder noise in the background. Okay. All right, so we have a question here online. Let me find my button here. Hi, tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Are you talking to me?
Yes, I am.
Oh, I thought it was somebody else. Okay. Luana Marie, I'm in Hawaii, and I had a couple of questions about taking your turpentine protocol. One was, in the paperwork I got online, it says to take one bottle of magnesium citrate. That's one of the choices. What size of a magnesium citrate? Is it like a 1 ounce bottle or a 2 ounce bottle? I don't know.
They come in 10 ounce bottles. It's a 10 ounce one your doctor gives you for your colon prep.
Did you say a 10-ounce bottle? The line is fuzzy, so it's been hard to hear this conversation today. So did you say 10-ounce?
10-ounce.
Okay. And then the other thing was, when doing this turpentine protocol for a lengthy period of time, which I plan to do, can I use, like, butter or ghee on steamed potatoes, something like that?
Probably not. You probably get better results if you don't.
Okay, those were my two questions.
That's wonderful. And people who need more information about that, they can contact support at vitalitycapsules.com. And we're putting up a web page for information about turpentine and all those kinds of things. In fact, I think we're even going to start. We're going to start we might even do a summer session about that. But yeah, turpentine is quite the miracle. Okay, yeah, so we have in the chat room, Jim Henson, the creator of the Muppets, was very wealthy yet died of pneumonia. Okay, and of course we can't leave out Steve Jobs. Oh no, Steve Jobs. At 50-something, and Michael Jackson at 50-something. So wealth in the United States is not a very good assurance of health. And it's because the most expensive things, which are most easily, of course, afforded by the wealthy, tend to be the deadliest. And I'm not talking about recreational drugs either. I'm talking about the real drugs, the real killers, the FDA-approved substances. In fact, it might be a reasonable thing to do for your longevity, health, and safety if you refuse any FDA-approved substances. Is this FDA-approved? And if they say yes, you say, excuse me, we need to use something else here, something that's not FDA-approved. And then you don't want to use anything experimental either. Experimental means almost FDA approved. So you don't want anything that's FDA approved or anything that's experimental. Experimental means that the doctor has applied for and received a new drug NDI, new drug indication protocol, which means that it's a substance that could be approved by the FDA. Those are two things that will really go a very long way with your health. The other thing is, if you have insurance, you need to really take a look at that. It does not make sense to pay your assassin in advance. That's not a good move. If you do not pay your assassin in advance, then when you come face-to-face with your assassin, and he presents to you his bill for assassination, I assure you it's not cheap. That's just not typical cheap. It's either through hospitals. It's a major profit center. They usually make four times as much on murder as they do on discharging a live individual. So when confronted with these individuals, with this institution, it is very important to say, I pay cash. If I die, nobody gets paid. And you would be shocked. You will actually get different handling. It will just turn things around incredibly. I was talking to a client of mine the other day, and she said, Dr. Daniels, I tried what you said. I walked in, and I said, I pay cash. And all of a sudden, everybody wanted to know exactly what I wanted done. It was an incredible feeling. It was wonderful. So I would recommend anybody try that. The words are, don't be afraid of sounding crash. I pay cash. And if you've really got nerves, if you've really got followed up with, if I die, nobody gets paid. Or not even if, when I die, nobody gets paid. Make that clear. And guess what? The doctor's not going to whip out the experimental drug when it comes to treating you. He's not going to use the high-level advanced risky protocol. Oh, no. He would rather be sure to get paid half a loaf than to push it to the limit and get no loaf when you die. So strategies are, I pay cash. When I die, nobody gets paid. And they might even turn you away. And if they turn you away, what they're really saying is, we're pretty sure that whatever we're going to do is going to kill you. So if someone turns you away because you say that you pay cash, and if you die, nobody gets paid, keep on going. Hold on. You go back home or go to the home of your best friend and just throw a party because you're going to live a lot longer. And that's that story. Let me check, see if you have any more questions. We only have 90 seconds left. Okay. That is it, I guess, for tonight. And I want to thank everyone for tuning in tonight and staying healing with Dr. Daniel. And we'll see you again next week.
Make believe.